Well, how was the other podcast?
It was good.
Yeah, you two-timing us, Chris.
It was for the release notes conference thing. Yeah. Doing a businessy talk there. They were like, just so you know, no techie stuff.
Yeah, Georgia's going to be there. Should be fun.
Oh yeah.
Let's go. Yeah, awesome. That seems like a good idea, actually.
Yeah, I mean, a business of software thing specific to our industry. It's kind of crazy that nothing's really been done in that.
No. Yeah.
In that exactly. realm, you know, it's really weird.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we had a couple, but like not enough. You know what I mean?
Especially there were. Because,
yeah, Molly from Omni Group did something, and AJ from Market Circle did. The year that you spoke, he did like how they track sales numbers and all of that.
There have been talks. There have been talks for sure. I just meant like a conference that's sort of like.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. No tech. This is all about the business of software.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we kind of need that because.
Well, because like there were great talks, like those talks you mentioned, which all sort of happened at different conferences, but it's sort of like I don't want to say it was wasted because there were good audiences there, but it's not like all the audience was in that mindset. So some people would be sitting right. in those talks and sort of being like, oh, you know, what's this crap about marketing? I want to learn about Swift, right?
Right.
You kind of need the right collection of folks, like-minded individuals for that.
Yeah. And getting it all together in one place is definitely a win.
Yeah. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, especially now because everything's so crazy with the Mac App Store and all that. App Stores in general, you know, like.
Yeah. It is, but I mean, it's not all about that. There's, yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's not like a bunch of people just come together and start complaining.
No, exactly. I mean, there's sort of there's two sides to it, right? Like, it's just like, you know, the theme of many talks at many conferences over many years have been, you know, I am successful on the App Store and I don't know why, but here's a couple of things I'm going to try and prescribe based on my right. experiences. Step one, be lucky and get featured by Apple. Step two, happen to depend on a technology that Apple wanted to push at the same time. Right. You know, it's, there's a lot of that where, you know, there isn't a lot of traditional marketing businessy stuff. And even the new style stuff, because that's the thing in our industry. There's a lot of people who just don't know about those other things. Like, what's this advertising about? What's this segmentation? What's remarketing? What's this? What's that? You know, like there's these crazy tools out there that people don't know about. Just as it would be cool to listen to somebody talk about, you know, some really crazy functional Swifty thing for an hour. I'd really love to hear somebody talk about how they used Facebook to like segment a market and target an ad at one group and an ad at a different group. And then, you know, using the entire crazy chain of tools actually tracked conversions and were able to see, you know, money in translates to money out.
Right. Too often that kind of stuff is seen as dirty or.
Right. And I always say, you know, engineers are allergic to marketing.
Yeah. But it's part of running a business. So
exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And you don't have to be underhanded about it. Like it doesn't have to be gross. It's as gross
There's
as you make it.
There's nothing wrong right? with it. I mean, right. yeah. I click on ads. It's not like they don't exist. It's like, holy shit, right. that sounds like a cool idea. Let me look into it. It's yeah. not like somebody's saying, if somebody's saying something like, I'm going to get abs by taking a pill. Okay. That's bullshit. But if somebody's saying,
what?
Hey, not that pill, whatever pill you're on, not that one. it's sort of like there's nothing wrong with it. It's about getting your message out there. There's nothing wrong with getting your message out there.
Right. I couldn't agree more. Especially because I mean if you're proud of your app, you can't just expect, especially now that so many Macs and iOS devices are moving, people don't know that your app exists.
Right.
And you can't just expect them to know because it's not like a small little community anymore.
Right. Just because you were, quote, popular on Twitter and got tons of retweets and stuff like that, that is still a small percentage of the population.
Yeah. Even somebody like Goober.
Right.
Very small slice of the actual overall Mac market, right?
Well, I would anecdotally, I would give sort of the story about back in the day when I would launch a fuzz measure update, I mean, Gruber's always thought my stuff's nice and he would link to me and I would get like tens of thousands of hits, but no sales. I mean, it's,
yeah,
you could get eyeballs, but if they're the wrong eyeballs.
Well, that's it, especially for fuzz measure. Right. I'm sure, well, I was one of those hits because I'm like, this looks awesome and I have no use for this.
Well, exactly. And I guess sort of you could logically extend that to sort of featuring on the App Store and so on and so forth. It's like,
right,
the kinds of people who are coming to you isn't what it's all about. It's not about being on the top paid list. Because guess what? If you sell to doctors, you know what doctors aren't doing? They're not looking at the App Store. Their IT department is installing the approved solutions that hopefully you're one of onto their device.
Right. And to get approved, you have to go through.
Well, that's a whole other thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to know who to talk to outside the App Store stuff.
Yeah, marketing.
And also Apple wants you to do marketing outside the App Store.
Oh, man. If
they think your plan is to just get featured, you're less likely to get featured because you're not investing in your own product.
Why would they
want to invest in it, you know?
Exactly. If you show up to like the App Store lab, which is amazing, and you're like, hey, you know, I would talk to somebody about marketing, I've got a launch coming up, whatever, you'll sit down with them and that's one of the first things. It's like, what's your marketing plan? What are you planning to do for your launch? You know, leading up to your release, what do you have lined up? And if you're like, maybe I'll buy some ads, they're like, yeah, I'll get in touch. And then you never hear from them again.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you go there and you're like, yeah, I got a team and, you know, we're looking into this and we've got this lined up and that lined up and hopefully it works and this is what we're intending to do, then they're like, okay, we could take you seriously. If, again, like you said, they're investing in you. There are a bazillion apps. For them to put you on a front page of anything, whether it be a category or whatever, there are other apps that are not in that list for that to happen. And they want to make sure that they're sort of spending that on the people who are, you know, devoted.
Yeah. You know, it's easy to make the argument that Apple's got billions of dollars so they can, like, the time that they invest
in it. It doesn't work like that, man.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's because even just because they have the billions of, like, I talk to people who are inside Apple and they're like, they're on the Mac side and they're just constantly fighting with the fact that they are dwarfed by the iOS stuff. And there's so much attention going to the iOS stuff. And it's like, yes, we could spin off a Mac business that is in the Fortune 100 and that just makes Macs. But, you know, it doesn't work like that. You're part of a bigger thing. There's different priorities. And just because there's a war chest of cash, it doesn't seem to be for anybody, let alone Mac versus iOS.
Right. Yeah, I agree. But plus that, man, if they spun off the Mac, I'd get depressed. It would be like spinning off
FileMaker. Yeah.
No, the example I would give would be Palm and Palm Source.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Look how that turned out.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Got a little insight into that one.
Yeah.
well, that was back when I was at B.
Yes. Well, let's introduce you because you know what? We're gonna keep
I know,
marketing because that was
good. Who is this douchebag anyway?
Who is this guy? Yeah. So Chris Licio, welcome to Debug. We've been talking about doing this for a long time.
2.5 years.
Yeah, you're one of my buddies, so I never think to talk to you guys.
We did ask, but he was busy with product launches.
Well, so it's a few things, right? I mean, it kind of goes both ways, like. You guys would ask me maybe when I'm in the middle of something and then maybe I'm out of the middle of something. And then, you know, you guys obviously have your stuff going on too. And, you know, it's a lot of planets have to align.
Yeah. And here we are all in alignment.
All in alignment.
With a horizon.
I had my equipment out and a Mac running 10.10 still that, thank goodness, nice. Is working.
Nice. Oh, man. So I'm on the road. I'm in California right now. And I have two laptops. I've got my MacBook Air running 10.11, and I've got my MacBook running 10.10.
Okay.
And my intention was to record podcasts on my MacBook using 10.10. And you know what I forgot at home? My USB-C to USB adapter.
Oh.
So I can't even plug my mic in.
I'm surprised you did the OSs in that order. I would have assumed you would have done the new hardware with the newer OS.
Yes, eventually it's going to get there because it's the new OS has better Force Touch stuff, which I really want to get into.
I did the same thing as Guy. I have 10.10 on my MacBook and 10.11 on my MacBook Pro.
Right.
I'm trying to remember the order of events. I think before I got my MacBook, I put 10.11 on my Air.
Well, it really depends which one's sort of your more main machine, right? I mean, like my Mac Pro, up until only just recently, I still kept it on 10.10. And only when I finally freed myself of the last of the Xcode 6.4 built projects that I shipped could I feel good about saying, okay, now I'll put 10.11 on this.
Yeah, my Mac Pro is still 10.10.
Right. It's 10.11. Well, so it's on 10.11 now, and it seems okay.
Okay.
I did have a couple kernel panics, but I think those are driver related with a specific audio device I have. But other than that, no. There's a lot of like GPU laggy stuff that used to be there in 10.10 that's improved in 10.11. I don't think that's necessarily metal related. I would just take a guess to say just they fixed a lot of problems as well. Because in my experience on other Macs, like the whole switch to metal wasn't like, oh my God, now this Mac is so much faster. Apple's always done an outstanding job of making those quote unquote crappy integrated GPUs run really well.
Right.
I've actually found in my experience, the suckers who buy the discrete GPUs seem to be in the worst positions in terms of UI performance. I don't know what it is. I feel like there's some fast path code that for whatever reason is just not being concentrated on after some period of time. And, you know, with the whole crazy relationships between the GPU vendors and actually, you know, getting change to happen, I can't imagine it's easy for them to say, oh, remember that thing you sold us like 6 years ago? You know, we want to just change how the driver works. They're going to be like, we're like three generations ahead of you right now. You know,
right, they would never.
Here's the code. Maybe you can figure it out.
Yeah. Also, like discrete GPUs, I mean, you're going to need a copy, right? Like, so the integrated stuff can at least address the same memory.
Right. But these days, those numbers of bandwidth are
so high that it
still won't read.
Is that still true on a Retina? Like a Retina MacBook Pro kind of thing? Is that?
I have found, at least, so I run my Mac Pro with a 4K display. And when I first got it, it was quite evident that this was not a common thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a lot of weird laggy issues. But that slowly went away over time. So there's definitely some kind of extra penalty for pushing. I mean, obviously, right? You're pushing four times as many pixels. Yeah. But obviously, they were able to do something to, I mean, crap, if you can't make a D700 push, you're doing something wrong, right? And obviously, they were doing something wrong for quite a big period of time. I would say that they were a good, up until 10.10, three, it was pretty rough going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have that issue where your screen will just go black on the Mac Pro?
I don't use a Thunderbolt display. You're using Thunderbolt?
Yes.
When I had my Thunderbolt display, it was so flaked out. I am so pissed about Thunderbolt in general. I am so mad with the physical connector. And I don't know why this isn't a bigger problem that people don't complain more loudly about. I feel like they totally, starting with FireWire 400, which was a nice solid connection when it attached, it was attached. Then they went to FireWire 800, which all the plugs I had were like these flimsy plastic things that were way too easy to be unplugged, but still pretty solid when plugged in. Every Mac I've had with Thunderbolt, a slight jiggle, just the slightest jiggle of the cable, and you lose the connection.
Which maybe that's what's happening to me.
Mine is so flaked out so bad that I have an interesting Herman Miller desk. It's called the Envelope, and you can actually pull it back so you can like lean back in your chair and like the desk kind of comes with you. And so as a result, there's a little bit of movement on the cables as it's kind of moving positions. With my Thunderbolt display, forget it. Every time I would try to adjust my position, I would hope that my cables would not drag enough to like cause this little jiggle. But there would be that one time where I would pull the cable back And obviously there were other things plugged into my Thunderbolt display and everything would go wonky. My audio devices would disappear. I had a Drobo attached and it would go away. It was terrible. I'm like, how the hell can they sell this thing as a good connector? They made Thunderbolt. Great. Then you make a cable called Lightning, which is like the strongest connection ever.
Yeah.
And they give that to a USB connection to a damn phone.
You want like a British naval connector end bit, right? So you put it in a twist.
Seriously, like give me a BNC type connector or something. Like it's not like this problem hasn't been solved before. Hell, do MagSafe for data. Like, yeah, it drives me bananas.
See, I have that problem with MagSafe. I plug it into my Thunderbolt display. The Thunderbolt's all great, but half the time I come back and the computer's not charged.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Connectors are the worst.
But they don't have to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I find myself, and I hate the fact that this is true, but I find myself using USB 3 more for stuff. And it's stupid, but it's just a simple fact that those connectors, for some reason, have been terrible. I've had a Logic board replaced on my Retina MacBook Pro because I brought it into the store and I'm like, I don't know if it's my connector. I don't know if it's my display. Can we just plug one of your like removable drives into this? Sure enough, he plugs it's like a lacy terabyte drive or something. He plugs it in Thunderbolt, gives it just the slightest jiggle, eject. He's like, yeah, that's a problem. They replaced my Logic board. Yeah, you think? They replaced the Logic board, new one, and it seemed okay at first, but it's still doing it. It's just Thunderbolt. I mean...
What do you think, the tolerances are bad or like just the actual design?
I have absolutely no idea. I am not an electrical engineer. I am not a mechanical engineer. I would not be able to look at either side of that connection and give you a straight answer on why I think that it's the case, because it goes fairly far into the plug. There doesn't appear to be a physical, a delicacy to the way that the delicacy, that's not... Is that the right word?
Close enough.
A delicateness.
Delicanosity.
Yeah. But there's no flimsiness to be detected in the way that the connection's being made. So I can't reason about why this is the case. And I don't know is it the fact that, like, you know how most of the time when one of these plugs attaches to a circuit board, it has to be actually attached to the circuit board. And depending on the type of connector, the manufacturers, there's usually a handful of manufacturers. I think Amphenol is like one of these manufacturers that just makes a billion of them, right? They have USB ones, they have Ethernet, the whole nine yards. And different manufacturers have ways of sort of mounting to the circuit board. And I'm wondering if the fact that, you know, Apple kind of doesn't control anymore, but the fact that they did the development of this Thunderbolt thing, maybe because of the thinness of the products and this, that, and the other thing, they kind of, you know, let a little bit slide on that mechanical aspect. And maybe there's actually a physical solder joint that's allowed to wiggle a little more than it should. I mean, I'm just totally making random claims.
Making it up at this point. But yeah, I could see that. Yeah.
Because I can make no reasoning about why this connector is the way it is. It drives me bonkers. Like, even this Thunderbolt display plugged into my Mac Mini right now, if I look at the cable the wrong way, the screen will go black.
Have you tried USB-C, Chris?
Yeah. I'm sure it's probably better.
I think the next Thunderbolt it's supposed to use the same.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. Is it more of a physical snap like the Thunderbolt? Or sorry, Lightning?
It's a lot more like Lightning.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a more physical snap to it.
Yeah, like you stick it in like maybe a quarter of an inch,
But does it like physically like click? Like, you know, when you plug
I'm trying it on my MacBook right now and it kind of,
it feels very Lightning-y. So,
yeah, like I can basically pick up my laptop.
Oh, okay. So you almost feel like you could pull the MacBook from the cable.
I am doing it right now. Sliding across the table. Now, granted, the MacBook's super light, but it's...
But that does give me some more
feels
hope.
Secure. It feels really secure, yeah. And that's directly away from the plug that I'm pulling it. You know what I mean? Like, not up. It's like the exact tension. So,
right. Yeah. I've heard things, sort of back channel type discussions from people who've done MFI work in the past. And I'll kind of hand wave a little bit, but they were saying that some of the specifications of the Lightning connector, in terms of like the mechanical specifications of the amount of force that that connection can take in either direction, is absurd. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why for a phone? I mean, are there ever that many forces at play versus like...
Well, they figure that people are going to be charging them in cars and on the go and on battery packs and all over the place. So they really over-engineered it.
Let's say that it does disconnect for whatever reason. You're not going to have data loss, like my Drobo disconnecting as I'm doing something. Not that it ever happened. I was always, because I knew, okay, I'm going to move my desk. Let me like save everything.
So what you're saying? The sync, like the terminal and force everything to sync thing?
Oh, yeah, it's stupid.
Yeah.
So what I'm hearing is that the Lightning team should take over the Thunderbolt connection, and then they could just be called the Thunder and Lightning team.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah,
there we go.
Storm.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so Thunderbolt 3 is using the USB-C form factor, which basically kind of makes my MacBook even an odder duckling than it already is. But whatever, that's okay.
And your Mac Pro guy.
Yeah, you know what? I like buying the interesting computers. I know that's probably not the smartest thing to do, but they're super interesting computers. So
there's nothing wrong with, you know, buying this stuff just out of interest, right? I mean, people have weirder hobbies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so the Mac Pro I use constantly for programming. Like that's my.
Oh work. Yeah, I mean,
the MacBook I needed because it's low end, and the app was kind of chugging on it on previous versions of the OS.
Oh, so, I push my Mac Pro so hard sometimes it's not even funny. And, you know, I'll get a little chuckle now and then when I can actually make the fan go a little bit.
Wait, do you run Arkham on one of the graphics cards and Tomb Raider on the other one?
No. Is that a thing?
For a while I had Arkham and a couple of games just open constantly.
Did it actually make the fans turn on?
It would, but I mean...
Well, I found it very
works
hard.
Fine.
To do.
Like they all kept working. Well,
they'll keep working. I'm just I'm amazed at what it takes to push that machine to actually make the fans audible. Like that is my favorite thing about the Mac Pro.
Yeah.
Like even my Thunderbolt display makes noise.
Right.
Because there's like a constant blowing out the bottom.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Like the fact that they made this crazy computer that is dead silent is fantastic.
It's incredible.
Even the IMAX, you know, with the spinny disc, is like you hear that constant breathing of the drive.
I don't know if I could go back to I like the IMAX, but
they'd have to be SSD only.
Yeah. Man, I really love the Mac Pro. It's great.
No, but even the IMAX would fan like crazy. I could get my I had one of those i7 quad core ones that, man, it was so easy to get the fan.
Well, it's like the standing MacBook Pro, sorry.
Exactly. And it keeps driving me nuts that there isn't that middle of the road, like desktop class hardware Mac. But, you know, it is what it is. If I got to pay more to get, you know, my ECC RAM, fine. I mean, at least I don't have
Xeon procs.
Right. I mean, it sucks that it costs more and I don't like that aspect of it, but at the same time, it's like, well, you know, I don't feel myself really wanting much more. It does what it needs to do. And when I do need to push the cores and stuff like that, it is nice to know that I can test some crazy multi-threading, you know, stuff that would normally, you know, with two or four cores, you're just not going to get those same kinds of race conditions that you can get when you've got 16 virtual cores all trying to shuffle work between them.
Right. Which you do. So let's actually talk about what you do.
Yeah.
So you have two apps, Fuzz Measure and Capo. I suppose you're best known for Capo at this point, right?
Yeah. And I would even call it three apps because Capo Touch and Capo are pretty big. Pretty big efforts in two very different directions. Even though they share a lot of code, I mean, I never had to rewrite anything for Capo Touch or vice versa, but I did have to re-optimize, which does feel a bit like a rewrite in some cases. So they do get significant bits of work, and they also have very different support and marketing streams as well. So yeah, they're two totally, producty products in their own right. But yeah, those are sort of the big two. I guess you could call them consumery, prosumery, which I don't know is necessarily accurate. I would say that they're more of a slightly more horizontal, vertical market. in that, or even still, they're understandable by a wider thing. I guess for people listening to this, the reason I'm making these distinguishing points is because my other product, Fuzz Measure, even if I do spend an hour trying to explain what it does, most people don't get what it does.
It measures fuzz. What's so hard to understand?
It doesn't help anymore. It used to measure fuzz. The test tone used to be a white noise signal.
It's a tool to understand the acoustics of a performance area, right?
That's one of many tasks. Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the more understandable things, and what I do try to relate it to when I explain it, which is, suppose you could go into a room and sample the reverb in the room. And that's kind of what it's doing, which is it's putting a tone out, a special test tone. It's capturing the result of that, doing some math on that to sort of figure out, what came back versus what went out, and then plots a graph, well, many graphs, but it does create a result that kind of tells you the impulse response or the behavior of the system that you tested. So while you could do that in a room, you could also hook it up to like a filter. If you had like an EQ, like a physical EQ, and you plug into the input and then plug into the output and you adjust the curves on the EQ, if you measure with Fuzz Measure, you get the graph of the frequency response of the EQ.
Cool. Yeah.
So I have some customers who are actually doing, electronics projects that actually test things like guitar pickups and stuff like that. Anything that has.
Interesting.
Yeah. Anything that has that type of concept where it is a system, and provided it is a linear and time invariant system, it will measure the response of that system. So basically, you kind of get an idea of what that system's behavior is. But yeah, that covers such a large.
Yeah, that is hard to explain. But basically, it helps engineers better understand the systems.
Exactly. Out of my own sort of use, I was building speakers for myself and got to a point where I was like, oh man, I need to just kind of run some tests or get some numbers. And I could use a multimeter and a voltmeter and a function generator and this, that, and the other thing, or I could just write some software and do it for myself. There was nothing on the Mac at the time, and I figured, hey, opportunity. Wrote my own thing, solved my problems, and then said, hey, does anyone else find this useful? And then started kind of selling it from there.
Right. And this was back in what, 2003,
2004. Yeah. I got my first Mac in early 2003. Yeah. I was still in school then. I was writing a real-time operating system for my fourth year class. We were writing an x86 real-time operating system, and I actually created a GCC cross compiler. So I compiled GCC to cross compile from my Mac to x86, and then on my Mac I was also running, I think it was either BOCHS or the other there was another x86, both open source freeware thing. This was back before we got VMware and stuff. Yeah. And
it was Power PC back then, right?
Yeah. And it was all just so I could work from home rather than, going into the lab at school and working on one of the, I think there were only like 6 or 7 machines there. And nobody wants to be in a computer lab in the math building at the University of Waterloo any time of day, let alone the real time lab. So yeah, I would do a bunch of that OS work at home, and it's totally not what you buy a Mac for, but it's sorry, I keep clearing my throat here. My partner in the class had a PowerBook G4, and it was a titanium one, and I saw him using it, being one of those like PC kids. I guess we should rewind at some point, but whatever.
Yeah,
being one of those PC kids all my life, you know, Macs are lame, blah blah blah. And this was around a time, I mean, again, this will make more sense when I go into the history. at the time I was more sort of in a Unix-y mindset, and I was like, wait a second, you're running bash in your terminals and you're able to like run GCC and do development like in that tool chain. Well, that's weird. And, you know, I kind of started thinking about that. I was like, well, man, I'm like screwing around with this old PC laptop that I had kicking around, which was garbage and, you know, wasn't really cutting the mustard. And I was like, maybe I'll grab a Mac. And then the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. I mean, OS X really did turn that around. I mean,
it did.
Not only did you get a real operating system, but it appealed to the geeks and web developers and everybody that needed the command line stuff too. So,
well, that was just it, right? I mean, there was sort of the constant problem with the Unix-y OSs was, but where are my apps, you know, to actually do the work, the MS Office, the accounting software, Photoshop, and so on and so forth. And so while people loved using Linux for development and playing around with that web technology stuff at the time, what do you do the rest of your day, right? And then you're dual booting, and what fun is that? So yeah, I mean, I had already gone through this sort of a few times.
So yeah, let's go back to the beginning.
The beginning.
Yeah. Well, little Chris. Little Chris is running around.
I mean, it all kind of started way back. I was probably like 7 or 8 or so, and probably hanging out with my cousin or something, and he had a Commodore 64, and you know, we told me things I could type into the computer to like print my name and stuff like that. I thought that was cool. And then shortly thereafter, I ended up with a Tandy Color Computer 3.
Oh, nice.
A good old Coco 3. And I had one of those, did a, you know, the typical thing. You have the ring bound books with games in them, and you type in the games, and then you have to type it again when you turn on the computer again. And then you get a floppy drive. Ooh, look at me. I got a floppy drive. I can actually save these things. And then it just kind of, you know, the typical story. You're typing things in. You want to change how a game behaves. You modify a bit of code. And
right. Then it works. Yeah, like you find the character literally the character, like the ASCII character that represents your avatar.
Your guy, yeah.
And then you change him to something different. Yeah.
Or you change the speed of the game, or, you know, little things like that. And I mean, it wasn't like in depth. I wasn't, you know, writing accounting software for people or anything like that.
Do you remember the little smiley faces in ASCII for like, I guess it was DOS ASCII?
Oh man, I used to do some crazy stuff back then. So my first sort of real computer was a...
I love that you used to do crazy stuff back then.
So I don't even remember at what age I was when I first started going on BBSs and stuff, but it was on a 286. It was a color 286. So it was kind of like the end of the 286s. Mm-hmm. And
is this CGA?
No, it was VGA. So that it was a weird computer at the looking back. It was a very weird computer because it was at the time the 386 was starting to kind of make its way out. And mm-hmm. I think I might've even had an ATI graphics card back then, which leads into something else. So I had that computer, and I had like a flight simulator game and test drive and other cool things like that. But then my computer, and I don't know why we had it, but we had a 2400 baud modem. And I want to say that it's probably because the computer shop we bought from just had a bunch of pre-made configurations, and you give them some amount of money and they're like, here, take one of these. Mm-hmm. And so we had it, and it had a modem, and it was sort of the same cousin that was, you know, showing me the basic stuff. He just gave me a list of phone numbers of BBSs and his login and password. And he's like, if you want to just check these things out, just log in, whatever. He didn't take it too seriously back then, and neither did I. So I would just, you know, call a number on the list, try to log in. Didn't work. Okay. Call the next number on the list, try to log in. Oh, this one worked. What is this? So I start looking around and whatever. So then you're going on BBSs, you're seeing this crazy ASCII artwork and stuff like that. And then brings you back to these weird smiley face characters. And I remember at some point actually having like those art editors where you edit ASCII art.
Oh yeah.
Do you remember those? Like
Yeah.
You actually had like a little palette at the bottom of the screen of those weird ASCII characters, you know, the lines and the angles and the varying shades of square.
Yeah. Like the dithered pattern. And like,
yeah, there were different shades of dither pattern and different colors and so on. So I was into that for a while. Around the 486 time, I was really into that as well. And also starting to get into like the mod scene. I was really a big fan of... Yeah. Of electronic music produced using, you know, Scream Tracker and
all the stuff that came from Amiga, but
yeah exactly,
like around the 386 period, the mod scene kind of moved over to the PC a bit.
Oh, totally, because people were doing, I mean, you had way more memory to play with, you had hard drives,
yeah,
more superfluous and stuff.
I'm trying to remember that Future Crew was a big one.
Future Crew, oh good god, yeah. I remember going to computer shows in Toronto and seeing like these crappy, now by today's standards, but back then they were like hot shit computers running the Future Crew demo. And you would, I probably know all that music by heart, like the order it's in and the artwork that you'll see and stuff like that. I even bought a 2 DVD collection of old demos. I have,
oh man, that's cool.
Oh, it's like the coolest thing.
Oh, and you should. I guess they're not.
I'll have to give you guys a link. If you guys remind me, I'll send you a link because you can probably still buy it.
Cool. Okay,
because basically a group of guys went around and said, hey, there's going to be a time where these computers won't be able to run anymore. Can somebody like hook them up to some screen capture hardware? And can we like archive these somehow so we don't lose them? So
they were mind blowing at the time. Like,
oh man, they were insane. And the music was cool too.
Yeah. And again, anyway, so a mod is basically MIDI, but through software. Because you get a sample, and then you can change the pitch, and then you can change the speed.
Well it's wavetable synthesis, and a wavetable is basically a lookup table of waveforms. So you think about like a sample of audio, like say a piano sound played at one pitch. But now if you sample that more quickly, you hear it at a higher pitch, and so on and so forth. Right. So you could load a certain number of samples into a mod file, and it was very limited, and you would have a number of tracks, and basically each tracks, as they encountered a note value, would sort of quote unquote render that sample at that pitch at that time, and it was all happening kind of live on the computer.
Yeah,
you didn't have reverb, you didn't have effects or anything like that. You could do things like pitch bend, you could do note on and note off, and you could change the volume, and yeah, people were doing some crazy stuff with that, because
I wrote one, but only for one track, and it was hard.
Oh, the kind of coding that they had to do back then for that was amazing. And
yeah, because you had to do it on the audio interrupt. Like the DMA interrupt would kick in, and yes, then you'd have to fill the audio buffer with like all of your stuff.
Yes.
And like, I was decent, but I couldn't, there's no way I could mix 16 tracks. I was lucky to get one working.
Oh, I know. I was never really at that level back then. I remember having encounters with assembly and stuff like that, while I was learning C, mm-hmm, and I kind of got it. And I distinctly remember printing like reams of paper of, because I was into BBSs. So I was downloading tons of text files and how to's and stuff like that, mm-hmm, on things ranging from like linear algebra to do demo graphics to, sound related introductory stuff, which I never fully understood. But because I was kind of doing all this stuff at the time, I was coming across all these cool uses of, now looking back, very basic technology, but I couldn't always wrap my head around it. And, you know, things like even reading assembly and Intel style assembly was a bit of a mind game, because for many of the instructions, the destination was on the left.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you don't know that secret, and again, I'm a kid, not surrounded by, you know, family that's technical or anything like that. I'm on my own reading text files about how assembly code works and totally missing like the important details, like what order the registers are,
right,
and stuff like that.
I could only ever read code that I wrote basically in assembly.
Right. And so there was a lot of that. And so at the time I was also young, I was probably like 9 or 10, 11, 12 years old. Right. Yeah. So it was kind of a weird time, but I was doing a lot of really nifty stuff with my computer and getting into more music and technology and also graphics through this other interest in the demo scene and stuff like that.
Well, if you had a VGA card, it was nice because...
Well, no, this was even beyond then. Like, I had that stuff way before I was really doing things with my computer. I was still sort of a kid playing games on the computer, kind of like a kid today. Like, my son plays Minecraft. I mean, he doesn't really have much interest in, other than, you know, the passing interest in what is a mod, and I'd like to make a mod. Mm-hmm. He's not like, you know, how do they make this? Like, how do they do the graphics? Like, it's not impressive like it was impressive then, because it's everywhere. Right. And... So back then it was just like graphics on the screen. That's not text. That's crazy. Right. So that's what sort of was exciting about it back then. So I was into graphics. I was into sound, all sort of through that. I was part of a mod group in Toronto for a while. And around the same time I was starting to get into like more serious, keyboards, and actually convinced, people to sort of start making the step up to MIDI. Mm-hmm. And we would use like the Sound Blaster AW32. I still remember. You could DRAM chips on it to load the sample banks and stuff. So I would load up sample banks, make my own custom sound fonts and stuff like that, and produce music. I had worked with a record company in Toronto for a while. Sort of through that group, we had put together a demo, sent it to a record company, and I worked with them on some remixing stuff for a while. But this was also at the time where, now I was in high school, I had done programming. I knew I was into development. And it was like, well, I'm not going to do music for a living. And I love music. I love playing around with music. But it's just, I don't know if I thought I wasn't good at it, or I just was smarter and knew that. I mean, it's an interesting career, but it's not really a career for me. Mm-hmm. And so then I kind of was like, all right, I'm in high school. I'm doing the... computer sciencey stuff. I had found the University of Waterloo while I was in school. We had gone on a school trip there just to check out the school. And I was like, yeah, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to the University of Waterloo, going to be in computer science. This is what I want to do. And did my undergrad, really got into more of that, pulling the graphics back in, pulling the sound back in, and all that stuff. And I remember my first year of university, me and a buddy had stayed up all night writing a 3D engine using MMX instructions, which were new at the time.
Yeah.
So we had written a 3D engine so that we could create a Winamp visualization plugin, because it was because bootstrapping an app on Windows to actually like just show anything on the screen is a huge amount of work, let alone, you know, doing whatever it is you want to do with that graphics context. So Winamp was like a nice low-hanging fruit. You got audio data coming in. You can draw some stuff with it. So me and this guy stayed up all night figuring that out. And he actually knew assembly. So he was teaching me a lot of the basics of assembly while, you know, we were kind of exploring this new thing at the same time. Mm-hmm. But we were doing it because we were starting the co-op process of sorts, where we wanted to make sure we beefed up our resume so that you're a kid in first year. You've got zero work experience. You've got zero on paper knowledge of anything. And you're basically just your word against whoever's reading your resume. Mm-hmm. So we were like, well, we want to put MMX on our resume, but not be bullshitting about it, right? So we wrote this 3D engine, whatever, and had a cool thing on our resume. So I'm applying to jobs as a co-op student at all kinds of places. And most of the times at the university, if you're in a low level grade, like your first year, second year, whatever, you're fixing computers at big companies. You're kind of shadowing another employee or whatever. You're more likely to be a low-level technical-ish job than actually having a coding position.
Yeah, which is kind of fair enough.
It's fair enough because, I mean, kids don't know what they're doing, right?
Right, yeah.
There are people who go into the computer science program and graduate really, really smart at computer science, but they go in computer science 100, where you are learning what a mouse is and how to type at the time, right? And they come out computer scientists, right? So there's a wide range of skill that would make it that way. Mm-hmm. But I thought, hey, here's a job posting from this company called ATI. I know ATI and they're in Toronto. And, you know, I'll be working on 2D display drivers. That sounds cool, but it's a senior job intended for like fourth year students. I figured, well, whatever, I'll throw my resume in the mix. So I get my interview and you get it on a schedule thing and you get to see who the other students are. I think this has changed since then, but I saw the interview schedule was fourth year student, fourth year student, fourth year student, 3B student, fourth year student, and then you know, Chris Lee show and 1A.
Chris Lee show.
And I'm like, oh crap, this is not good.
Yeah, punching a bit out of your weight class there.
Yeah. So, but I got the interview, right?
Yeah.
And so I sat down, did the interview, and the guy's asking me, like, so this MMX stuff, like, what can you tell me about MMX? And I told him about the different registers and the register sizes and, you know, how you have to switch between the different modes on the CPU and stuff like
right.
that. Yeah. So then he's like, okay, because I think he was expecting me to not
to flub it, like give a generic answer, like,
or not have an answer, because a lot of people pad their resume.
Right.
And
yeah, yeah.
Then he starts asking me, because I had said I had done some Windows, like Win32 programming. I had done other things with Windows, and he was asking me about some generic Win32 questions. And then he started asking me about 3D stuff, because I said I did some 3D programming as part of this 3D engine.
Yeah.
And I mean, we were putting points in 3D space. It wasn't rocket science. But he was asking me how texturing works and how to, and what's MIP mapping? What does that mean? How does that work? And
I'm asking, oh, you knew MIP mapping at the time. Okay. That's pretty advanced when you, yeah.
But I just knew of it. Like, I hadn't implemented it, but I was just answering right. these questions thinking, okay, they're just testing general knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm answering these questions, so there were two guys in the interview room, the guy who would be my manager at the time, and the other guy who was like his manager. So he was like the manager of device drivers at ATI. So this guy is flipping through my resume and all the paperwork on the thing. And he stops us in the middle of the discussion. He's like, are you seriously only in 1A? Like, is this a mistake? I'm like, yeah. So then at this point, he's like, I have been interviewing kids in fourth year all day who know nothing. He's like, unless this kid who comes after you is like a complete genius, he's like, you got this job.
So, I love the preface.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, okay, that's a good sign. I had never done a job interview in my life until this point, and this was like my first experience. So it turns out I was part of this team that worked on 2D display drivers for Windows NT4, and we had started work on Windows 2000. And man, talk about being thrown into the fire. I was doing Pascal and stuff like that in university and had done a bunch of C stuff on my own, but never like work experience C. So the first thing they gave me was like, here, implement drive transparent blit, you know, the other side of the transparent bit blit on the driver side, like implement this. Here's the data sheet for the card, whatever. Let us know, you know, what you get stuck on. And so I was like, okay. So I kind of went into it. I learned, you know, the ins and outs of talking to a graphics card and sending commands to the command queue and how this all works. I'm like, oh, okay, I get this, and, you know, did my work. I did well, and I shipped code as part of Windows 2000 because, you know, the drivers ship on the CD.
Yeah. That's the CD. one of the best releases. Well, you know, until
it was. No,
yeah,
I
it was great. Yeah.
It has absolutely nothing to do with my driver. Trust me, my little bit of code. It was a
solid, but I mean, it's ingenious.
It was a very solid release, and we had actually started bringing up the Direct3D driver.
Wow.
But the problem was we faced a little political thing where the people who were doing the Windows 95 and 98 drivers, they were basically paying the bills because, you know, ATI graphics had to be super, super fast on the most common, you know, end user experience. And so while we did implement like the first crack at it, I think it ultimately got taken over by that team, and, you know, all the shady, dirty tricks of the graphics industry ensued from then on.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, while I was at that job at ATI, I had come back for another term. And during that term, I had sort of got back into like wanting to learn about alternate operating systems. You know, you're at college, you're experimenting with different things, trying a little Linux. And because the undergrad environment at Waterloo is all Unix, like System V Unix, like Unix.
Oh,
Unix.
Yeah.
So you're either on System V or you're on Solaris. System 5, right. System V, I don't even know.
And, 5, but whatever, yeah.
Right, so your experience is entirely through a terminal. Like, not unless you're going physically to the labs where you have an X session and all that stuff, I would actually, I guess I was SSHing in more often than not and just using Unix to do my assignments. So, you know, getting more familiar with the Linux and Unix and playing around with alternate OSs, and I want to get back into doing my fun programming on audio again.
Mm-hmm.
So I come across Next a little bit on the web because they had a pretty rich audio API.
Yeah, they DSP were basic, in the first ones.
Right, but they were dead at that point. Like it was after the end of Next. And I was like, oh man, what a bummer. This was really cool, but whatever.
What's your 95, 4?
This was 98, 99.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So they'd already been bought by Apple.
Yes. Yeah. Oh,
cool.
Okay. I hadn't followed any of this stuff. I wasn't an Apple guy. I wasn't a Next guy. I was firmly in the PC camp. I mean, I was PC, PC, PC. I built my own computers, did the whole thing. Wow. And I mean, that was the environment I worked in at ATI. So I came across this other operating system called BOS. And I was like, oh, this is really cool. And, you know, you see the demos of the media and it's C++. It's a pretty nice interface. It's got crazy multimedia. So I'm going to try playing around with this. So I ordered myself the disk. And so in my spare time, after I had my day job at ATI, I would go home and wanted to tinker around with my BOS. Well, this was about the same time that broadband internet was a thing. So to access the internet, I wasn't using a modem anymore. So I hooked up my trusty dusty computer, installed BOS. Crap, I don't have a network driver for my interface. So the only way I can do programming on BOS is if I, you know, boot over to Windows, figure things out, boot back to BOS and whatever. So I was like, well, screw this. I'm going to write a friggin' network driver. I mean, I write graphics drivers. How hard could a network driver be? So I started looking into, you know, how do you write a network driver? Let me get the data sheet for my thing. I mean, I knew how to write a driver. So I just kind of followed the steps of you need a data sheet plus some idea of how to write that type of driver in the OS. So I was following articles by this guy at B, and I reached out to him because I was in the middle of writing my driver. And I said, hey, I got my driver mostly working, but I'm having these problems. Can you help me out? And he was like, wait a second, you wrote a driver and it works? I was like, yeah, I mean, I kind of got some help from, you know, there's Linux code out there, BSD code out there. I had an idea of what to do.
Yeah, the shape of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And his article had a sample network driver, right? So, I mean, I put two and two together. I built this and he's like, you want an interview? I'm like, sure, but I'm an intern. He's like, yeah, don't worry about it. We have an intern program. So I did a phone interview with them. They were like, oh, dude, you're so getting a job here as an intern because... I mean, why wouldn't we hire you? You've already done the kind of work that we need.
Yeah.
I was hoping that they would put me into the media team because that's where my passions were. I had written shareware for BOS and stuff like that at this point, some audio software. And unfortunately, there was like a little mix up in HR and they were like, nah, you're on the network team. And I'm like, fine, whatever. So I ended up working on So the focus switch happened between the point that I got the job and started. So now B was doing internet appliances.
Yeah.
So when
is it focus switch with?
That's what they called it. That was the word. The
focus switch. Yeah.
Focus switch.
Yeah.
And it was such a bummer because as a media guy, this was at around the same time that eMagic had a version of Logic running for BOS. Steinberg had a DAW running on BOS.
Oh man.
And,
digital audio workstation.
Yeah, yeah. So like, well, Logic is Logic. Right. It's the same Logic. It got bought. So Logic was running on all these audio apps. And B basically turned around and said, you know, we're doing this different thing now. So now I started work at this company that doesn't really do this stuff anymore. But there's super, super, super smart people and really cool work to do. And I loved every minute of it. Like I was totally the idiot in the room every day. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
I was writing network drivers. I was working on the Novell NE2000 driver, which was like...
Was that Ethernet or was it token Ethernet. Ring?
No, okay. I think it did a bit of both.
Okay.
I think it did 10 base T and 10 base 2, which was the BNC one.
Okay, yeah.
So that was basically an architecture that was developed in 79, I think. And it just kind of over the years, it was one of those sort of like how ARM is evolving over the years. And people would just say, okay, we make an ARM chip and we make an ARM chip and they pay licenses for that stuff. But it's the same idea where there would be an
ARM goes back to the 80s, like the Acorn.
Right, exactly. So it's the same idea. So there was this NE2000 and it was a very basic and not particularly great architecture, but it worked. And so I was working on that driver, which actually covered a very many number of actual physical cards. So it just happened to be the one that was going into one of our bigger internet appliances. So I worked on that. And I was like using all these kinds of tricks and double buffering and this, that, and the other thing. So I could, wow, I could saturate the 10 megabit line, right? Mm. It was actually hard to do with this card. So that was a cool work term. I worked on that and kind of came out of that. Really
wait, sorry, wait, I just wanted to ignore it, but didn't the double buffering add latency? So you could saturate the bandwidth, but you had like a little bit of lag?
This is networking though, right? Like this is
yeah, but you're still double buffering. So you still like what could have gone on the wire is not going on the wire until you.
This was double buffering in the sense that there was a ring buffer on the card. And it could,
oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, so it could hold yeah. something on the order of, I want to say, two reasonably small but average packets of network data, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
Or no, it was approximately, that was the MTU, it was about 1500. I think it was 4K, but
so somebody, that's like one packet.
Well, it was
full package.
Potentially more. Yeah. So somebody figured out, and it was, I think it was Donald Becker or somebody like that who just writes network drivers for Linux and FreeBSD and stuff like that. And his driver, he did this double buffering thing. And I was like, oh, I'll try that. Because what he decided was that instead of when you get sent a packet and you push it out the wire and then you kind of wait for it to go and then you have to wait for the card to send it and tell you it's ready for more data, instead you send one, and then while you're waiting for that one to go out, you can enqueue another one, right? So you almost build a bit of an outgoing queue so that you keep track of what the status of each one is so that you can know, you know, you can still inform people when their packets don't go out and so on and so forth.
Yeah. That's cool. You're keeping the tap running basically rather than...
Right. It was really, really neat. Yeah. And the only problem was that every once in a while, if something bad would happen and the card would stall, then you would have to reset the card. So I think I was the only driver at B that was spinning up a separate thread in the driver to handle that reset because it would take a second and a half. So on some other OSs, if you had this card, you would actually have a pause in your system because it was interrupt time when this had to happen.
Ooh.
Anyway, it was a hot mess, but I managed to make this happen. It was really fun. And I got assigned to do more, better, cooler drivers for network hardware, including the Intel EE Pro and the 3COM 3C90X series, which were really friggin' cool network cards. Those started pushing up towards gigabit now. And so I got to work on that, although it was like targeting the desktop OS, and we weren't really doing the desktop OS, but we kind of needed the desktop OS in order to develop the internet appliance product. So it was like not really going to be a product, part of the product, but it was really cool because I got to learn tons of stuff and kind of work in this free environment of, hey, I own network drivers in BOS for a little while. Like, that's cool.
That is awesome. Plus, I mean, anything that you learn on the desktop can filter back down into the appliances, right?
Like, well, it was.
Either the technique or
it were the same.
Piece of hardware was excellent. Yeah, okay.
But it was the same thing. I mean, just if you could imagine how, you know, OS X runs on the phones, it was the same idea. Technically, you could write certain types of drivers for the Mac that I bet are the exact same driver on iOS, right? Like, I'm sure that there are chips that exist on the Mac that also exist on the iOS, and there's probably the exact same code running both. Because it can't.
The Bluetooth thing or something, probably.
Right, exactly, because it's that type of thing. And that was the logic. I would write for the desktop, you get it running for the desktop, and then if somebody came along with an internet appliance that was, say, an x86 architecture with, okay, we'll pick the Intel EE Pro because we want it to be, I don't know, better, I guess, we would have a driver for that. So I was working on stuff that was sort of like didn't have a clear product, but it eventually did. So I did take it seriously, even though I didn't have to. But it was fun because I was an intern and, you know, I got to kind of do what I wanted. But I was going to try to continue that work term. And that's the time when Palm Source basically was buying them and they weren't going to renew my contract. So I ended up going sort of in a totally different direction and got, as a co-op student who was kind of looking for a job during the actual work term, I got to get a job at Raytheon, a radar company in Waterloo. Well, division of Raytheon that does radars. Radars.
So the nice part of it.
Yeah. In fact, I was specifically working on a project that was built for, it was called the High Clutter Tracker, and it was built for search and rescue in high sea states. So it was a radar that would be on a ship where if somebody went man out, if there was like a man overboard call, they would light this thing up and it was able to detect, I think the specifications was it had to detect a human head in a, like a 1.3 meter high sea state or something like that. Like there was some crazy specification we had to meet. And I mean, I didn't design any of this stuff. I was just a kid kind of hired to write data into Excel spreadsheets. But I was like, wait a second, Excel, are you kidding me? You guys have a site license for MATLAB. So I ended up going way above and beyond on this job and wrote this really cool like test data system where I would like put these fake ships that were going through these fake high sea states and passing data over TCP/IP to like the actual tracker. And I was able to write tests for the actual radar system. And they were over the moon because they were like, wow, we didn't think a student would actually do work. there's a lot of that. People don't know how smart co-ops can be. You know, if you let them do work, they'll do really good work.
And they're like excited and dedicated to it.
Exactly. I mean, I was doing all kinds of crazy stuff. I'm like, hey, I could do this if you want. I mean, and they're like, wow, you could do that? Totally. So I did some embedded systems work, did some of that stuff. Took another job from there at RIM doing business development stuff. And I was trying to sell their radio modems. And yeah, that was kind of crazy. So then that got
me. That's a bit of a switch. How come were you on the technical side of the sales or what?
Yes. Oh, that was a really cool job. I feel like I'm giving like a really long dramatic reading of my resume here. It was an interesting jump because I knew that I wanted to eventually start a business. I mean, I grew up among entrepreneurs and I knew that's what I long-term wanted to do. So this job at RIM was important to me to take something that was not necessarily technical. So it was in business development, but it was supporting our engineering customers. So RIM had a line of OEM radio modems that would get integrated into, you know, the Panasonic Toughbook, that like ruggedized laptop. That's like waterproof and drop proof. And you see them in every cop car. And they had 3G radio. Or sorry, at the time, this was Mobitex going into GPRS.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know RIM was involved in that stuff. That's cool.
Oh, that's what started. I mean, RIM designed their own modems down to like they made their own custom antennas, their own custom GPRS stack. They had their own.
So they started as like a Motorola competitor almost?
Yeah. They were totally a Motorola competitor. There was some significant, real, hardcore engineering happening at RIM. And being a part of the radio modem team, I really got to appreciate the complexity of cell networks and the kind of stuff that goes on there. And so I was there supporting the companies like Panasonic and Verifone. You know, they have those payment terminals. Well, they had versions that would work over cell networks. So, you know, we would support them. And support pretty much was along the lines of, they would be writing code against our radio stack. And it's really just AT commands, like modem commands to kind of wake up the modem and stuff like
ATD,
that.
ATD, ATH.
Yeah, that type of stuff. With obviously much more on top of that. And you can open PPP sessions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we were supporting the software side, but also the hardware side. So we would have the data sheets and they were like, you know, we've got these power requirements. We're trying to feed, you know, this amount of power to it. And we're noticing that it's operating at a spec or whatever, this, that, and the other thing. It's going to sleep when we don't want it, blah, blah, blah. So we had to support that kind of wide range. So it was almost like technical support, but on the engineering side. You can almost look at it as DTS for hardware. Right.
That's fascinating. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, so it was really cool. But in my typical task of wanting to make the job my own, I teamed up with one of the sales guys who was trying to push our new GPRS radios to customers that had already integrated the Mobitex radio. And because we were smart on the engineering side and made it PIN compatible, it was almost a drop-in replacement. But I was like, hey, if you let me do it, I will grab one of these toughbooks. I'll take it apart and I'll actually put the new modem in. And then I'll write, you know, a little bit of code on the Windows side to start up the PPP session. And then we'll just take these laptops out and do live demos showing people like Panasonic and stuff. Hey, we did it. we put the new modem in your laptop with, I'm not an electrical engineer. I didn't have to change your circuit board. And we went in, did that. I had the software to run it and stuff like that. So we were able to go out on, I was able to go on some sales calls and show physical hardware running the thing and saying, here's the benefits. Look, now not only are you don't have to use your custom software solution that talks to the Mobitex backend, you can now talk straight up TCP/IP over the internet, over GPRS radios, using no code. You know, I just had to write a little bit of code to manage the state of the modem. So
that's a pretty good pitch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's how I saw it. And the sales guy I worked with, Wes, was like, he loved it. I mean, he was always so excited. He's like, what else can we take apart? What can we put this in? And we had done a bunch of things. I mean, some of them did involve a bit of soldering iron work and a couple of extra lines here and there, because some devices didn't use all the features of the modem. So there were some pins we needed to hook up, but that wasn't like the majority of the work. It was just cool that I was able to do kind of what I did as a kid. I used to take apart clock radios and stuff like that, right? I always dinked around with electronics and do that kind of as a job in sort of a legitimized fashion, even though I was really just screwing around. I mean, at the end of the day, we were like, let's see if this works and let's see if we can make a sale out of it, right? And I did that for a while. And then after that, out of school, I did a little bit of work with a local contracting house, worked on a game port to the Mac, because again, I still really wanted to go Mac. And then I got moved to a project where I was working on that Longhorn, the Direct3D to OpenGL translator thing.
Right. So let's just describe that briefly.
Yes, that was a cool thing.
Yeah, so Windows used to have what was called ICDs, installable client drivers, for OpenGL. And then what? Like, so come Longhorn, they want to reset OpenGL atop of Direct3D directly, right?
The other way, yes, that's exactly it. So what would have to happen is, and it was terrible. If you were an end user, it was a nightmare. If you bought a really good graphics card, and let's say you want to play games, well, you would download the latest Direct3D driver, and those would be kept up to date. They'd be high performance, and you know, they'd be paid attention to. If you were doing 3D modeling and stuff like that, or CAD or whatever, you needed to use an OpenGL driver for your hardware to hardware accelerate OpenGL. So now you were hoping that your manufacturer was good about, you know, keeping your OpenGL stuff up to date, because hey, I paid good money for this good graphics card, I want the best performance.
Microsoft, I shipped an OpenGL game on Windows. Yeah.
And it must
so yeah, these ICDs were painful. Pain in the ass. Well, also there was OpenGL, and then there was the OpenGL subset that Carmack used for Quake 3.
Right. And
that subset worked pretty well, but you know,
I think Valve was a
Valve helped a lot with that. Yeah,
they helped a lot with the push for OpenGL, because they are OpenGL, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they helped a lot because, you know, if it wasn't for companies like that, there would them and, you know, Carmack side, there would be OpenGL would have been dead a long time ago, like a really long time ago. On Windows.
Yeah. And so for some years it was Microsoft being a jerk.
I don't know. I don't know that it was entirely that.
Well, because, I mean, it was a bit of both, right? Like,
because you could look at it two ways. One way you can say, oh, Microsoft's trying to kill Direct3D or OpenGL in favor of Direct3D. But on the other side, if you look at where Microsoft was back then, it's very similar to where Apple is now with things like web technologies and 3D. Like, if you look at what Apple's doing with Metal, they're saying, look, we can't depend. Well, it's hard to use this as a perfect example on iOS because they own the entire stack. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it on the Mac side, if they had to depend on NVIDIA and ATI to always have the latest and greatest up-to-date OpenGL features implemented in the driver with maximum performance at all times for OpenGL, that's already a big undertaking. And for the Apple platform, that's it. Multiply that by two. On the Windows side, Microsoft's facing this thing where we're selling computers into the pro markets for OpenGL, and we're selling computers into the consumer space into, you know, 3D gaming. And 3D gaming is pushing 3D acceleration forward really, really, really fast. Mm-hmm. And OpenGL is moving like an iceberg through molasses. Like, they're not adopting things like shaders fast enough. They're not adopting flexible pipelines fast enough. We want to move at this speed, and OpenGL's moving at this speed. And so I think Microsoft wasn't necessarily trying to kill OpenGL so much as Microsoft was in the situation where they wanted to sell their hardware vendors on the idea of just write one. Write a really, really, really good Direct3D driver that takes full advantage of the metal, and we will do the stupid OpenGL thing. We'll try to make it as fast as possible so that you just have to do the work once.
Okay, and so wait, this is the Longhorn era.
This was Longhorn.
Yeah, so yes, that I totally agree with you. Certainly by Longhorn, OpenGL was like stuck in the mud. The first Direct3D was like, it had like a retained mode and...
Yeah, oh yeah, I mean, it was very much OpenGL. Insane. Yeah.
No. The first Direct3D was not like OpenGL at all. It was Direct3D 3. No, it was behind. It had retained mode and the API was all screwed up and COM objects.
It retained an immediate mode.
Yeah, the immediate mode is a little bit better. Immediate mode is more like OpenGL. Retained mode is basically a scene graph.
Oh, right. But like, this was around the time where they were doing all that weird managed object stuff.
Yes, exactly. Come Direct3D 3, things, you were totally right at that point. Like, Direct3D started moving and OpenGL got stuck in the weeds. And certainly by the time Longhorn came around, OpenGL had been doing nothing. Like, to the frustration of even OpenGL proponents were like, well, screw this, because it's just nothing's happening.
Well, it was terrible. And because it shouldn't be that way. I mean, no one vendor should really own something like that. And, you know, there's a little bit of sort of worrisomeness on that regard with Metal. Like, one could argue that Metal might be going down that path, but I would counter argue that Metal's intended to be sort of so low level that, you know, well, game developers are doing this anyway, right? Mm-hmm. Metal's just another target. Even if it was OpenGL on Mac and OpenGL on Windows, you're still fighting with the differences between OpenGL on Mac and OpenGL on Windows. It's never a zero effort thing. I think Apple's sort of facing the problem, at least on the Mac side, I would assume, that they're sort of stuck in this mode where they're having a tough time getting the platform vendors to move as quickly as they want them to. So if Apple wants to say, hey, we want OpenGL, I mean, what's the version du jour? Is it 4 now?
It's 4.2, I think.
4.2. So if Apple wants to step up and say, we want 4.2 and we want 4.3 by this date, the hardware vendors, who I think still have to produce the actual driver, at least in the AMD case.
Yeah, it's like a micro driver, and like most of the high level extensions are done by Apple. As my understanding, and then the submitting the commands to the card is all kind of done by the ATI guys.
Right.
From my understanding, which could be off, you know?
So yeah, a lot of that stuff is sort of interesting in the sense that, you know, on one hand, you can kind of compare it to what was happening back then where, you know, the platform vendor wants the world to move at a certain speed in terms of more features, better performance, and so on, and more flexibility, better quality output. And the industry can only move so fast in terms of they could produce the hardware really, really fast and really, really capable. I mean, ultimately, they're driving the performance side way faster than the software can keep up. And then you have this middle ground OpenGL group who's like trying to play catch up, which back then, I mean, I would have argued that back then they were probably almost 3 to 5 years behind what the cards were capable of doing.
Yeah, they were for sure. Yeah,
the cards were basically talking directly to Direct3D at that point. Like I remember seeing some of the internal ATI data sheets. Some of the registers on the card, their values matched the OpenGL enums, right? Oh, like man. You were basically passing the enums directly into the card. And then slowly over time, there were things on the card that they didn't have an analog on the OpenGL side. So therefore, they were the Direct3D enums following those. And it's like, so the cards kind of have to go, you know, skate to where the puck's going, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this whole move forward with Metal, and I think there's an open source standard version of something like Metal. I don't remember what it's called.
Vulkan is OpenGL.
That's it, Vulkan.
It's the Cronus group. The people behind OpenGL are doing a Metal-style API call.
Yeah, it's Vulkan. The public name of Mantle, or the release name of Mantle, right?
No, Mantle is ATI's direct to the Metal stuff. So there's a few. There's Direct X12, there's Mantle, which is ATI's effort, or AMD, I guess, at this point, and there's Vulkan, which is the Cronus group's approach. Basically, everybody's tossed out the old school OpenGL-inspired APIs. like the original OpenGL inspired APIs, and now they're going to this command buffer GPU, not like the G right. as in general purpose, you know, rather than graphics processor.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where everything needs to head.
Yeah, but I totally agree.
It's clear that obviously everybody's having trouble kind of converging on. I don't know if it can converge on one thing, but it would be nice.
Well, at least we're in the experimentation phase now, right? Like everybody's
exactly.
got some race, we'll see what happens. So.
But then it becomes a game of like, how low can you go, right? At what point are people just saying, okay, the standard is just, you know, AGP 3.0, right? Like you're just talking to a card over a bus. Here's memory and here's a command list.
Right. Yeah. And to your point about Longhorn, Vulkan is driven by the Kronos Group, but that also means that at the same time, it's going to have some of the politics and the sort of running through molasses aspects that OpenGL had. So I can understand why Apple just is like, screw it, we're just going to do our own thing. Microsoft's going to do their own thing. I have no idea what Android does. I don't know.
Yeah. I was going to say one positive thing, at least about all this, as far as I can tell, and again, this is as a sort of an Apple fan, but you will notice that on these sort of molasses moving boards, there are members from Apple. It's not like they're not participating in this. They're definitely participating. They're definitely making suggestions and contributing totally. Yeah. So it's not like they're anti-standards. And that's hopefully nobody totally takes that away from things like Metal. It's not like they build Metal because they want it to be something different. I think if it was a perfect world for Apple, they would design something like Metal and kind of say, okay, here's Metal. Here is a way of doing this. And let's move this over to a standards group. That just can't happen very easily.
No,
I don't think.
I don't think OpenGL is going anywhere or OpenGL ES. I think it will, like what you're talking about, like what Longhorn was trying to do, where they put OpenGL on top of Direct3D. I think we're going to end up with OpenGL and OpenGL ES atop Metal on the Mac and iOS. And it'll be a perfectly viable, good API if that's what you want to do with stuff.
Right. And something like Metal allows Apple to do basically like that Longhorn thing where they get to write, hypothetically, write something like a shim that translates from OpenGL to Metal so that Apple just has to do the work once. They concentrate on making Metal amazing. And, you know, if you as a developer want to choose OpenGL, you can rest assured that it'll work. And it'll work as good as it can on top of Metal. And as long as OpenGL isn't doing anything too out of left field that can't be accomplished by Metal, which I don't imagine is going to happen, then, you know, that would be a problem. But I don't disagree with that movement.
So all of that aside, this was you were part of the effort at Microsoft.
Well, I was working for a third party company that was contracted by Microsoft.
Okay.
And only because they had done one of these once before for a different purpose. And so I didn't last too long at that company because I would have stayed at RIM had there not been a layoff back then. Like I would have probably worked there right out of school because I really enjoyed working there. That was, you know, another experience where I felt like I was around lots and lots of really smart people and I was learning all the time. It was a cool experience. So there was sort of a little bit of an uptick again in RIM behind the scenes. So they had reached out and said, hey, by the way, you know, there is a position sort of in around the same area. And so I was able to sort of finagle a job back in there. So I ended up working on something completely different again, which was, I don't like staying still apparently. I worked on, it was called the BlackBerry Connect.
Yeah.
And BlackBerry Connect was a technology that allowed third-party handsets to integrate with RIM's backend. And what we supplied was a straight C library, which under the hood was targeted at embedded systems, including, I want to say, the Nokia 6 series phones. They were like, I want to say they had like 100 and some odd K of RAM on these things. They were very, very limited. We were only allowed to allocate 128K of RAM. Yeah, that was our limitation. So we had to work within very constrained limits, but we had to talk to the RIM backend. So we built an API that was something like, you talk to our C API, you implement a couple of stubs. Like when we ask to send a packet out the 3G network, you just take our data and put it out on the radio. We don't worry about how you do that. Mm-hmm. So we had that team, and I worked on sort of the core team, which was the C API team. And we also had teams that were specific to Windows Mobile. So they wrapped our API in like a DLL that mm-hmm. gave a bit more niceties for the people like HTC and Samsung and other people at the time that had Windows Mobile phones. That, you know, ran Windows, WinCE embedded, I think, at the time. So we had a team who did that, and then we had another team that was specific to Symbian, and I don't think we had a Palm team. Palm dealt directly with our core team. So, yeah, I worked on this core C library, and I was responsible for the calendar protocol specifically. And it was pretty much just like protocol work, back and forth, working with, you know, appointment synchronization issues and, you know, making sure that we caught the different recurrence formats and stuff. And I had to design an API in straight C that made it straightforward to create appointments, again, in straight C, and communicate this to either, well, to our backend, which then had to figure out whether it was running against Notes or Exchange or I want to say NetWare. I think we had a NetBound.
Wow.
Groupware? What was the third?
It was IBM's thing, I think. Or was it? I don't know.
So we had a Notes. What was the other one? There's Exchange, Notes, and the other one. Crap. It's bugging me. Anyway, I want to say it was a Novell thing, though.
Yeah.
And that was a whole other server team. But yeah, we had to work on this API, and it was really neat work. And again, I was around very smart people who were very good at embedded programming, and we wrote a lot of interesting things. I had a lot of interesting projects that kind of spun off in there. I did a little bit of cool prototyping stuff. And this is about the time when in 2008, before then, right? I started working on FuzzMeasure in 2004 while I was at RIM on the side, just playing around with this tool. And it wasn't until 2008 where I was like, I'm going to take a bit of a pay cut, but I think I want to do this full time. And that's kind of where the smug story takes off. It doesn't begin. It began in 99 while I was at school.
So smug is super mega ultra
groovy. Super mega ultra groovy, yeah.
Which came first? Like, was it a backronym or what?
It was a bit of a backronym. It was, yeah. I don't know if you remember the Simpsons episode where they go to Japan and they're on that game show and it's like, you know, adjective, you know, super happy family, fun time or something. Like it was a ridiculous number of words.
You know what? I'm going to lose a lot of listeners and respect here. I don't follow The Simpsons that much. So,
you know what? It was,
I haven't seen that many. And it was like 20.
Yeah. It was a classic one. Yeah. Anyway. So it just, for some reason I was like, I want to do something kind of weird with the name. And I wanted to be something like super happy, ultra fun, magic, you know, do not
super
talk,
happy, super fun, happy, fun ball.
Right. Yeah. It was sort of along those lines. But I was also sort of intrigued by the idea of backronyms and stuff like that. And I don't know how it all came in. Groovy was cool, super cool, you know, and I kind of combined it together and I came up with Smug and I was like, okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
And so I put that together, totally not thinking that, hey, I'm going to be doing this for the next however many years. And it just kind of stuck. But that I just stuck with the name because I was figured, yeah. Hey.
No, it's a good name. It's kind of funny because you're one of the least smug people I know. Like, well, you have a lot of humility. You're not a jerk in any way. So.
Yeah. Well, there's a second definition that's lesser known of smug, which has to do with, I want to say like a mixture of correctness and perfection or something.
That's probably why like it morphed into being like an insult kind of thing. Like
maybe
like posh used to mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never really looked into it too much, but, it's one of those lesser known things, but it's a fun name. The FuzzMeasure thing was really cool. And I mean, that's all along this whole thing. I mean, I was talking about network drivers, graphics drivers. It was like graphics network graphics, a little bit of mobile network. And it's like, where's the audio stuff, Chris? Like, where did that come in? Yeah. And it was that sort of underlying current of, I was always into music. I did the music thing. I was really interested in, you know, DAWs and which at the time were like MIDI only. And I remember Cubase Audio came out. I was so excited about the oh my God, you can put audio beside MIDI. That's crazy. Right. So while I was in school on the side, I was self-teaching, you know, I was teaching myself, signal processing, because I was in the math faculty. We didn't have signal processing classes, and I wasn't smart enough to do the triple E option, which was you could take electrical engineering courses and get a double major. So that wasn't happening. And I was teaching myself the signal processing stuff along the way, trying to do little experiments here and there. And, you know, when the opportunity kind of fell in my lap where, I mean, I knew I wanted to write Mac software, because one of the other reasons I got a Mac was not just, you know, hey, this is cool Unix-y stuff. It was, this is a really cool platform, and there is an opportunity to write software for this platform. And it's
you'd started looking into Cocoa and stuff at the time, and being
exactly, I mean, I saw it as an opportunity. That this is too bad I wasn't smart enough to execute on what I wanted to do at the time. I was getting married, and I was like, I should buy some stocks too.
I think you made a better choice. Getting married is
It wasn't even that. It was just I was never into the stock thing, and. Right. But I was like, you know, my type of investments are, I want to throw myself at this Mac thing. And I really want to learn how to write software for the Mac. I really want to write shareware for the Mac. I want to do business with these people who use Macs, because, you know, it's just a different world.
Yeah. Shared and value set.
There was a
culture,
very,
I suppose, but
I mean, not to get too elitist about it or anything like that, but there were stats at the time talking about the percentage of Mac users that had post-secondary degrees was very high. The percentage of Mac users with a household income over a certain amount was very high. And I mean, I had grown up sort of in the PC days where, let me tell you, we didn't have tons of money to be buying tons of software. So I grew up among the world of, you know, kids pirating software. And back then it was just what kids did, right? And I knew that it was a very different world in that regard on the PC. You know, it was crack this and where's that. And people were stealing software left, right, and center, even when they had no business doing so. I mean, I saw it all the time in professional companies, and you hear it coming out once in a while now where like a big organization gets busted because they were using cracked Photoshop all along. You know, like that's just a very sort of PC mentality that I had grown up around. People I knew who made their money with computers were using pirated copies of software, and it was just kind of like the status quo on Windows. Whatever the reason was, I don't care. It's just the way, it's what I grew up along. And when I saw the Mac and this whole, I want to say, a thriving community of people paying for software and happy to do so, while I knew there was that sort of, you know, undercurrent of pirates, it was totally not like, that was not the signal that rose above the noise. It was actually the opposite. And I sort of saw that as, hey, this is a world I want to be a part of. And that's kind of what got me into this excitement about, I want to do something for the Mac. And, you know, I'm not the type of person that's like, I want to start a business. I'm going to leave my job. And now what? I'd sort of said, when the right project kind of lands in my lap, I'll cultivate it and see what happens. And that's kind of what happened with FuzzMeasure. It was an experiment I did on the side, and people were willing to pay for it. And not only are people willing to pay for it, they're willing to email me and ask for more features and different ideas and send me research papers about, you know, why I should be doing this type of measurement as opposed to this type of measurement, and why this graph is important and not that graph, and what this graph tells you, and so on and so forth. So it was like a very collaborative experience with my customers. So it just
Which is terrific, right? Like
It was amazing. And I mean, now I have different insights on that. It has, apparently that has a lot to do with the type of software and the price of software and the market that you're selling to than the actual Mac world as a whole.
Especially now, because Macs are almost ubiquitous at this point, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's a totally different world. And, you know, it's an uphill battle to convince people who came from that Windows world of, you know, as far as they were concerned, software didn't cost anything. And you could argue for days about where they got that from. I mean, even ignoring the piracy thing, if you think about where people interacted with computers the most, it's at work. They never had to pull out their wallet and buy a piece of software. No, it was installed on their computer when they got there. They just had it. And if they found something they needed, they mentioned it to their boss, and suddenly it was there. So this whole concept of end users paying for software wasn't necessarily like super widespread, because most people that interacted with computers were interacting with them at work. And still that's largely the case, right? You think about people who work in construction fields and home building and stuff like that. They use their computers to, you know, take care of their accounting, you know, do some correspondence and here and there. And in a small degree, maybe they do something related to their work, but not very much. They work with their hands and they're busy during their days.
Which is also why the market share argument in terms of
PCs versus Macs.
PCs versus Macs and where it's better to sell software is a bit of a red herring, because most of those PCs deployed have a very low possibility that they're going to buy any software. Like, it's not, they're effectively not a platform you can sell software. They're not a unit you can sell to, because they're, you know, there's no capability for them to buy anything. As opposed to a Mac in an individual's hands,
right?
Then you can sell them a piece of software that suits their needs. So it's,
exactly, it's a much more personal device in that.
There's like a multiplier there, or, you know, like it.
Right, and I also knew that because I was doing audio related and selling sort of into the music industry and the pro audio industry, that it was heavily Mac skewed anyway. Even though there were plenty of PCs, and there still are very many PCs in the music world, it's still very heavily weighted towards the Mac. And the same thing applies. Do you know how many huge studios have cracked copies of like plugins and other stuff like that, stolen like sample libraries? And it's just, I don't know what it is. It's this thing that, you know, because people can get their hands on it, they do. And it's just a different world. And I like the fact that, you know, the experience starts with the Apple Store. You walk in an Apple Store, you're not getting a discount for what you're buying. Nothing ever goes on sale. The price is the price. It's the only place to buy it. You've already set that expectation. If the customer has had to go through that, they've obviously demonstrated that they're fine paying money for something that is quality, right? They're not turning around and buying an Android phone necessarily because it's like the more awesome option with a more complete story of user experience. They're buying it because their carrier said, hey, we'll give it to you for $20 on a contract, and, you know, we'll also give your wife a phone too and your kids and whatever, just to get you to walk out with that Android phone, because that sales guy is probably getting an extra $20 in his pocket, right? You've done this unconscious filtering of your customer base before you even started developing, by developing for the Mac and iOS. Because the people who've walked in the door have already demonstrated that they're willing to buy a better good. They're not forced into it. They're not doing it because it's cheaper or whatever. Anyway, with that said, that's kind of where the impetus was to develop solely for the Mac audio products. I mean, the APIs, I fell in love with the Core Audio and other APIs from the beginning. It was great that I could build something that had a business use case for the acoustics world and that whole world. And then, you know, when I did finally get to go full time in 2008, I had all my time to myself. I worked on the product and I was like, well, now my hobby's going away. My hobby of writing Mac software. Mm-hmm. So what am I going to do as a hobby? I'm going to go crazy if all I'm doing is writing Mac software 24/7. So that's when I was like, oh, okay, I'll buy a guitar. I'll take it serious to learn guitar. And that's kind of where Capo came from, because now I found myself with another opportunity. I was learning guitar. I needed something to slow music down without changing pitch, and found a bunch of solutions and tried them. And I was like, wow, people aren't doing this properly. they're cross-platform. They're ugly. They're hard to use. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it right. I'm going to make sure I use Core Audio. I'm going to make sure that I, you know, do the signal processing right. I'm going to make sure that this, that, and the other thing. You know, at this point I had won the design award for Fuzz Measure, and I thought, well, you know, I want to make another well-designed app. It would be really cool.
You want to build a wall out of ADAs.
Yes. Yeah. A fort.
A
fortress. Yeah.
It never came to that. That never came into anything. It was totally about, I've obviously proven myself as somebody who's able to do something well with this Fuzz Measure stuff. I wonder what would happen if I did a more sort of mass market meets crazy signal processing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Capo just kind of came out of that. The first version was very much like the products I was trying to replace. It had a very simple feature set. But once that got out the door and demonstrated that people liked that, I just saw it as another opportunity to say, okay, now what if I really show them what I'm made of? What if I, you know, do some of this more funky signal processing stuff? And, you know, that's where sort of the OpenCL stuff came in, because, right, you know, that kind of came out and I was like, wow, I've got this really intense processing thing I want to try doing. I wonder if this will work. Turns out it worked great. And Apple seemed to enjoy that quite a bit.
Right. Well, they should. I mean, you did a great job. One of the things I love about Capo is it is deceptively, it's dead simple, and yet behind the scenes, there's some crazy math and just crazy software stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean,
we talk offline or whatever.
Yeah,
we talk,
yeah,
privately quite a bit. Like, you jump through a lot of hoops to get this stuff working, and when you see the app, you're like, oh look, everything's working, and that's cool. Like, it's cool, but people don't realize just how much elbow grease has gone into making that actually that slick.
Yeah, I just as somebody who's, you know, really good at, say, design, either from a visual or industrial point of view, would sort of obsess over like these little details about, you know, it's got to look right, but it's also got to feel right. It's got to feel good in my hands. The weight's got to be good, this, that, and the other thing. I do sort of the same side, same kind of thing under the hood, right? You know, if I'm going to try and do something that might touch the audio and produce sound, I want to make sure it sounds half decent. And let's say I am able to solve a given problem. Like, so a long time ago, I created the vocal reduction plugin that I did, and it's not entirely sophisticated. When I started it, I built it and I was like, I completed my first pass and I thought, hey, this sounds really good. It solves the problem. But I wasn't done, because I was like, I knew that there were four or five more things I had to still try in order to make sure that I at least attempted to make the audio sound as good as possible. You could take that to extremes and kind of sink your life's work into doing that. But it's an important part of what I do, which is, you know, finding the research, implementing the research, and hoping that maybe you can kind of push things forward a little bit. Because there is a lot of research out there, you know, with fully outlined approaches on doing very sophisticated things, whether your field is graphics, functional programming, signal processing, whatever. There's a lot of material out there and there's a lot of theoretical stuff. Sometimes it's been proven in like research prototypes. Some universities will let their researchers do like these sample projects and stuff like that, or the researchers will go to conferences and demonstrate these sample apps, but they never turn into anything, because there's like this other whole gap. Like, after you've done the work to even understand what it is that they've done to achieve a result, and they've demonstrated it, but sometimes that thing is like running on MATLAB with like a taped together chunk of code under the hood, which requires a ridiculous computer and it has to be rebooted every 15 minutes, and it's just not practical.
Right.
It works, they've demonstrated it, but now you've got the challenge of once you, as the independent observer, figured out the approach and even got that extra step of proving that you could do it, now there's the other step of, how do I make this run on a bloody actual piece of hardware and not blow up?
Right. Well, and in your case, in iOS, like a phone, which is
that was
remarkable,
insane. Yeah. I had no idea how big a gap that would be from A to B, because, I mean, I had absolutely killed myself from the time when I got the prototype working, and it was taking like a couple minutes to run through a song and do the chord detection, and I had managed to get that time down to like a couple of seconds on my Mac. If I didn't have the presence of mind just to say, let me just see how bad this is on the phone, I wouldn't have realized that, oh crap, it takes like 10 or more minutes on a phone. I mean, I still had so much to do. And there's so much of this crap that we have to do as developers, at least on the signal processing and graphics sides. We solve a lot of the same problems just in different ways.
Yeah.
And it's just, you start with this elegant like expression of what it is that you're trying to do in code. And it's like, okay, I got to take this data and I got to manipulate it and put it over here. And now I have this result and it has to move over here. And then these have to be split apart and then moved over here and then added and this, that, and the other thing. And then you get a result. Well, then once you actually put that on a device, you find out, oh crap, that takes like a gig of memory. So now you have to like totally take your beautiful code and just turn it into a disaster because you're reusing buffers and the names of the variables are all ugly and you can't read the code anymore. And so that was a whole ordeal. Going back into from Mac to iOS was a challenge, but it was totally worth it because, I mean, I think a lot of other developers, when put in my position, would have just sort of thrown up their hands and said, yeah, this is crazy. I mean, 10 minutes, like that's bonkers. I mean, it runs like in a couple, like 10, 15 seconds on my Mac, but it runs 10 minutes on my phone. It just can't be.
This is for what, like a 2 minute song, right?
Right. Exactly. It wasn't like I was, you know, taking a 4 hour podcast or something. Yeah. It was a reasonable size song. And I'm so glad I did the challenge because later on I learned sort of the hard way that there are a lot of interesting sort of copyright issues with respect to chords and manipulation of audio and detection and so forth. And I think it's common for people to say, well, it runs great on a desktop. It runs like crap on mobile. So I'm going to solve this problem by just putting my logic on the server, right? Problem goes away. Well, right. The problem is now you're putting yourself in harm's way because you're going to upload your songs to a cloud somewhere. Well, guess who owns, quote unquote, the cloud? You do. Mm-hmm. And now you are in possession of copyrighted content that you do not have a license to do anything with.
Yeah.
And once your code is making copies of that audio, guess what? You're infringing copyright with like every move of like the buffer. And it's happening on your computer. From like a legal point of view, you're exposing yourself to all kinds of problems. Whereas when it's happening on device in the possession of the user with the content that the user has the rights to and so on and so forth, it's a totally different story.
Wow. I haven't even thought of that aspect of it.
And life gets even crazier with Apple Music now because nobody has the rights to what they can stream and nobody understands this.
So
we have an uphill battle.
It took Serenity like 24 or 48 hours talking to copyright lawyers just to do a basic primer about that yesterday.
Right. And that was just answering that question.
Yes.
You know, because now the question is a little bit different if she were to try and address the issue of why can't I put my Apple Music tracks as a backing track in my home movie?
Yeah, she was just doing why can't I heart a track this in Apple Radio? And the answer is because they have different rights for Apple Radio, for Beats Radio than they do for Apple Music than they do for iTunes Store.
Yeah. It's difficult. It's challenging. And I sort of struggle with that on one hand. And ultimately it's an issue of user education. Like I don't necessarily see this problem. Well, one could argue it's not really a problem. It's just people own copyright and they want to get paid for what they did. That's fine. That's fair. It's just very difficult in this day and age to put those boundaries in place and yet still be viable for a consumer to participate in that. I mean, look how long it took for iTunes to go from a totally DRM lockdown, painful experience with your music to now when you buy an album on the iTunes store, you no longer have to authorize a computer to play it. Like that's huge. That is a big difference.
And it's different than video and then books. Like ebooks are still bad. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it's difficult, and it's one of those things that it's an industry that is trying to fight to survive, and they have every right to, but they're ill-equipped to fight that fight. That's what sort of sucks about most of this. You know, you have that whole that Sony rootkit exploit from years ago, where you know they tried to distribute a game and put some copy protection in there. Who wrote the copy protection? Well, I think they outsourced it or something. That's not always the right answer. And, you know, something bad happens because they're not crypto experts and security experts and this, that, and the other thing.
In the PlayStation 3, they put a whole virtual machine to run everything through in Java, I think, just to sort of protect the pipe so you couldn't copy stuff out. And that made the entire system not as performant as the...
And it's a bummer because I really want to sympathize with the copyright holders to say, yes, you totally deserve to get paid for your efforts. This stuff is not easy. It's not easy to write a song and produce it and get it out and get people to listen to it and get it on the radio and this, that, and the other thing. It's not trivial. And when you do get lucky enough to make it and everyone knows your song and loves your song or whatever, you deserve to, you know, sleep on piles of cash if if that's what you've got coming to you. But, you know, don't ruin my... Don't make me suddenly hate to buy music or buy the content that you're producing.
I have a 7.1 surround sound receiver here that I can't use because there's something wrong that makes it always say it's HDCP non-compliant, even though it is, and it's out of warranty, so they won't fix it without me paying more than it would cost to buy a new one. So I said I'm never buying one again, and I just plug something in on an optical cable now.
Yeah, I've been kind of on a sort of small to medium scale. When I built this house, I have a bunch of video distribution to move. Like my receiver is in a different room from where my TV is. And in order to get like the content to go from, you know, Apple TV all the way to my TV and show up, it was a lot of crazy stuff that had to happen where, you know, like the receiver has to do a handshake with a transmission device, which then has to learn the other side of the handshake from the actual TV set so that all this information is kind of cached along the way so that these devices can kind of masquerade as the endpoint along the way. It's insane how this whole thing kind of works.
Wait, doesn't that man in the middle just break the entire system?
Not entirely.
Or is it more like a...
As far as I understand, there's licensing that happens in between. And it's not necessarily... It's not all about the content protection. In fact, I think the receiver is the point that has to, like, the negotiation happens between the device and the receiver, and then it's up to the receiver to send to the set. But I don't know if the receiver also forwards the handshake onto the TV set, because the decoding technically happens on the receiver, because, you know, they've got those upscaling chips and stuff like that. Technically, they're rendering the video on that device. And then from there, it's a matter of passing the content out. And it has like a flag to say that this is protected and maybe there's like a little handshake, but it's not as involved. I think the bigger problem is negotiating formats. So it's just like when you plug a monitor in that can say, hey, I can do these resolutions with these refresh rates and vertical sync and H-sync and this, that, and the other thing.
And if you stick a KVC in between,
you're screwed. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the same idea, but think of the KVC being able to learn the... Well, it's still EDID. It is EDID. It's so you're learning the EDID of the TV that you are talking to over this, in my case, a 10 base T or no, Gigi. Yeah, gigabit Ethernet. It's like a Cat 6 cable or something. And, you know, over that cable, this stuff moves across with hopefully the right format tags and stuff. But man, setting it all up, getting it to work, pain in the ass. But yeah, it's the industry of, you know, copyright protection and DRM and all that stuff it's a difficult thing to navigate. And as an app developer, I just want to make sure that I can give the user the experience that makes it easy for them to comply. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to have to wholeheartedly say, or sorry, I don't want to have to say carte blanche, like, okay, you can't see this music. It's not accessible. You're done. You know, and then they come to me in support and say, hey, this doesn't work.
Right.
I want to make sure that I can go into this and sort of be able to produce that experience to say, hey, this is sort of the state of affairs. You know, you need to understand that you can listen to the song and it's great that you found it and you've discovered this artist or whatever, but just, you know, complete this next step, you know, give the artist a buck for the song, then you can continue. Mm-hmm. But I have a feeling that that's going to be an uphill battle for developers for a while.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, I mean, it took ages to get access to the music library on the phone, right?
It did.
So maybe there'll be
for those reasons.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's going to happen on all this comes down.
I don't think anybody could tell you. I really don't. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough sell though. Like, why would a publisher give up the same rights for a tiny fraction of what they paid before or what they were paid before? I don't see them doing that.
Chris Ziegler from The Verge tweeted out yesterday that there are very slight Apple Music audio stamps or watermarks on the Beats Radio broadcasts. The only thing I can think of is that's for the analog tape loop.
Oh, interesting. Wow. Oh, my God. Yeah, this whole thing is so... It's fascinating, though. I mean, as a consumer, it kind of sucks because it's more confusing than it needs to be. As a developer, it really sucks because I have to, you know, kind of cope with the fallout. But as somebody who's sort of just interested in how the sausage is made from both a legal and technical perspective, it's all really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Too bad you can't ship that fascination as an app.
Well, yeah, I kind of do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, that's. I hadn't even considered how Apple Music would affect your stuff.
Yeah,
but I mean you can just. I suppose you're right. Just encourage people to actually buy the song rather than renting it.
Right. I mean, I'm not gonna try and like you know snarf some audio stream that's flying through in some other process or hack it and try to make it happen. I mean, there's other apps on the store that do things like offer. Oh, you can go to YouTube and use a YouTube video as the audio source for my app where you can learn the song. And it's like, I mean, I could probably technically figure out how to do that, but I'm just begging for trouble, right? I mean, there's so much stuff on YouTube that shouldn't be there.
Yeah, that seems weird. I mean, you're going to get Prince's lawyers calling you for one.
Well, you're going to get every lawyer calling
you. Yeah.
And I mean, I'm trying to do this for the long run. And I don't want to have to stop doing this for a living because I made one of those decisions where it's like, oh, it seems like the right thing to do to make it hopefully a lot of money in a short period of time. Right. That's gonna be the end of me if I do that.
There's no guarantee. Even if you do everything right, we've had a bunch of our videos frozen for copyright, and we've had to prove to YouTube, and it's music we've made ourselves, all in-house stuff, and they've frozen it and demanded that we prove we own copyright to it.
Right. Yeah, it's a crazy big problem. And it's from a technical standpoint. I mean, what if you were on the other side of that? How would you even implement the other side of like making sure all this stuff is kept kosher? That's even the fascinating part.
I don't think you can really.
They do some crazy like audio fingerprinting and matching. And
the fingerprinting is one thing that you can do, but...
You can do cover song detection.
Can you? That's pretty cool.
Oh yeah. There's a conference, a yearly music information retrieval contest, and they have these different challenges. One of them is like chord detection, one of them is beat detection, and another one is cover song identification. And it's kind of like, you know, they have ones for compression algorithms and so on and so forth, where you can like, you know, be the king of the hill, win the contest of being the best compression algorithm. It's the same idea, but it's like, can you identify the most cover songs among this huge data set? So you submit like your app, your binary, it's just a command line thing. They give you input, you spit out output, and then they score everybody. And cover song detection is one of those ongoing things that I think for reasons like this, people want to be able to detect that.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. So I actually have to kind of wrap this up.
Sure.
What we didn't talk about is all kinds of technical stuff that I did want to get into with you.
Well, can we do a part two?
There's always time for a part two.
Yeah, because I really kind of want to focus on a lot of the work you've done with the Accelerate framework,
yes.
Swift.
Oh, yeah, that whole thing.
All of the graphic stuff that's going on behind the scenes.
Bytecode.
I know you're doing
bytecode. I barely looked at bytecode.
Well, I mean, it turned out it's not what you think it is. Well, I mean, it's not, it doesn't, anyway, whatever. Yeah, you told me that it's, you know, it's not.
Yeah,
it's like you can retarget another processor. So,
and even if any of that stuff was the case, there are people way smarter than all of us that they don't sleep at night unless this is right.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So I sleep well at night knowing that.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. We're in good hands. But yeah, Chris, it's been awesome. I can't believe it's taken so long.
The longer you take, the more parts it adds to the end.
That's going to be okay, though. Because honestly, I think we could have like another 2-hour talk just about all the in-depth stuff that you do.
I'm going to give that Ganatra fellow a run for his podcast hours.
Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah, it's so crazy. I mean, I didn't even realize I'd go so far off the rails with like the work history stuff.
It's so great, though.
I actually kind of expected it because I am fascinated by that. And I guarantee you there's people out there clamoring to know more about what can it be.
And yeah, that's the other thing is like I barely even touched on like there's that cool story I think I told you once or twice where a guy showed me how to shove a screwdriver into the ISA slot to trigger a breakpoint.
Yeah, you're just ram full of like funny stories. Yeah.
It's yeah,
and there was a story with a parking lot too.
And a heavy object. You were consistently one of the best conversations I have at any trade show that you're at.
Roof disposal. Yeah.
I wasn't there for that.
But I just liked it.
The fact that they distributed that on the product disc, like the two sample movies that shipped with every BOS install CD were the guys doing roof disposal from two angles.
So in the meantime, Chris, before we have you back, where can people find you? Where can they get more information on you and your products?
You'll find information about the company and the products at supermegaultragroovy.com. And you can learn more about Capo specifically at capoapp.com and FuzzMeasure at fuzzmeasure.com. Awesome. And I'm on Twitter at Lisho, LISCIO.
And it's an account filled with smart stuff, so it's a really good follow.
Hopefully a high signal to noise.
Well, you've got all the stuff to measure it by, so you can tell us.
Yes, true.
Guy, where are you these days?
I'm at GTE on Twitter and have an app in the Mac App Store called Napkin.
Which we're basically trying to use for a book. It's awesome.
That's great, yeah. And everybody, please just go check out Capo because it is a phenomenal piece of work.
Yeah. Get multiple copies. Buy them for friends.
Well, even if you don't play music, just try it because it's if you're interested in software, it's definitely worth checking out.
And just seeing a song go through it is an amazing experience.
Oh, yeah. People have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. Cool, Chris.
Thanks so much.
So, yeah, we'll get back in touch and talk. Then we'll talk nerdy.
It's like what I said at Singleton, right? Okay. This is going to get technical now.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Chris.
Talk soon.
Bye.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.